Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Gamers Without Borders. We've got a pretty special episode here tonight because we've got the Sega 60th anniversary, the Sonic the Hedgehog 30th anniversary, and we're just going to sit down and have a nice big Sega discussion for this episode. I'm Patrick Mifflin alongside Teresa Sammons, Lee Lamb, and Kayla Owen. And Filippo D'Onofrio is joining us again. Always good to have him around. So yeah, getting right to it. Sega's 60th anniversary is this year, and we've already heard some things about the plans that they're making to celebrate. But to start off, I really just wanted to reflect on the first 60 years, and I think the one defining moment for me, as far as my interaction with Sega's line of IPs and just Sega products in general, was the Dreamcast launch. It really made system launches into can't-miss events for me. And it's the reason why, since that launch, I've missed a number of system launches that you can count on one hand. Everything about that day was just a joy to look back on, and the whole experience of congregating with all these other dedicated gamers outside of the various stores around town and accumulating all of the Dreamcast stuff that I was going to end up getting for launch day. That is really what I wish system launches still aspire to.
Yeah, that's something that we have lost in modern times, but no.
Yeah, it's kind of a different time now, because back then the amount of people that played games was a lot smaller, and it was a tighter knit community. Whereas nowadays, yeah, okay, video games have become popular, but with that comes the drawback of every Tom, Dick, and Harry is playing games, and some of them have various, interests in. Just, well, some people just play Call of Duty, and that's the only thing they play. Some people will only play like Farmville and on their phone, and that's fine. But it's also kind of meant that when a system launch comes up, then a lot of people see opportunity to make money.
Subhuman trash, I like to call it. And on top of that, just the sheer volume of gamers that we have today. And I'm not saying this as a, speaking of that as a problem, because the more people playing video games, the better. But it definitely stresses the supply chain heavily. And I think even if you took scalpers out of the equation, you'd have a lot of supply problems because all these systems that are being scalped, unless they're going for truly absurd prices, there's a buyer for them. And, even if every one of these systems were going in directly into the hands of somebody who would, open and play them, that's no guarantee that the launch day supply is going to satisfy the demand, just because gaming is so ubiquitous now. And even though revenues have kind of increased, more than increased to match it, revenues are ridiculous today, but they can't just ramp up the supply chain exponentially to match.
It's not
And
that they
that's
don't want to.
no.
It's right now we're in some really weird times, and it's like even if they can get the CPUs and the GPUs the supply that they wanted, they're supply constrained on, a bunch of other parts that need to go into a PS5 or Xbox Series X. So it's not just one thing, it's just a supply constraint on just about everything, and that's what we're seeing.
But even before that, you had, like, I remember when they were getting ready to roll out the Nintendo Switch. It wasn't even called the Switch yet. It was the Nintendo NX. And Nintendo placed their order with Foxconn, and Foxconn basically asked them if they were high. And yeah, they got probably about half of what they ordered for the launch. And they moved. I mean, they sold
everyone they got.
But, yeah, it's just supply cannot catch up to demand the way it is today. I think the level of FOMO is so ridiculous now. Like, I don't understand why the PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series were regarded as can't-miss products when they offered virtually nothing that you can't get elsewhere. So, that's what's truly baffling, is that just by virtue of launching a system, whatever, you know, even if it doesn't have anything in tow, it has become a can't-miss event for a lot of people. And that, to me, is just kind of strange.
I see what you're talking about, but it's hype. It is much hype.
Yeah. But on the plus side, going back to Sega as a topic here, I think the Dreamcast as a guiding philosophy may be more alive and well than ever. Just if you look at the games that have come out specifically in the last 2 years, but this goes back a little further than that. Just looking at the kinds of games Sega have been releasing, looking at the kind of games that other studios that are clearly very influenced by Sega have been releasing. If you were to stick a Dreamcast logo on anything that was derivative of that design philosophy, I think it would be all over the place.
Yeah, like Streets of Rage 4, you could totally see that on the Dreamcast.
Streets of Rage 4, Shenmue 3, Phantasy Star Online 2, just this huge wave of games that keep it coming because this is the good stuff.
Yeah.
Another thing I want to point out is that their JRPG pedigree does not get its due at all.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to Sega JRPGs, you usually come back to two franchises, Phantasy Star and Shining Force. But then you've got Skies of Arcadia, you've got Landstalker, you've got the rest of the Shining series, you've got, Panzer Dragoon Saga. Just this huge lineup of JRPGs that maybe if they could have kept their momentum with it, might have
taken off.
Been there in the class of a Square Enix, or, you know, back in the 90s, they almost got Falcom. Yeah. So they joined together long enough to make one game, and then they kind of went their separate ways. But yeah, that would have been a really interesting turn of events. And then finally, another thing that really sticks out to me is that they are really one of the last bastions of pure arcade gameplay. They were there for the real heydays of arcades, the 80s style and the 90s style. And whatever flavor of arcade gaming you want, they have it. Some of it you might have to kind of dig for in 2020, but it's out there. And if you love arcade gaming, then Sega has more than enough to feed your appetite for it. But that's really what I keep coming back to when it comes to Sega. How about you, Phil?
Well, for me, the times that I keep going back to as far as, you know, good gaming times for me is usually the early to mid 90s when Sega was doing their scalar arcade games, like, you know, Rad Rally, Radmobile. They had a few others. Well, you know, Power Drift, but that was earlier. But it still falls into that same kind of genre. I really loved those types of games because there was just some kind of artistry about them. Like, you could, polygons were starting to come into vogue back then. But, you know, it really didn't look all that great. There was just
Suzuki did not want to wait for polygons to
catch up.
To catch up to make 3D gaming. And yeah. So,
and he made 3D gaming. Yeah.
He made it very well.
Yeah. So it was that era. And, you know, obviously the Genesis was hugely fondly remembered for me. And I still play Genesis games like all the time because they're just that good. I don't know how many times I've gone through the Shining Force series because it's just fun. Been experimenting with ROM hacks for those, and some of them are better than others. But that's, you know, the case with a lot of ROM hacks. It's just you never know what you're going to get. But as far as their JRPG stuff that you were mentioning earlier, it's weird because I think in Japan that happened a little bit more than it did here. There's a lot of stuff that they released in Japan that never saw the light of day here.
Sakura Taisen.
Yeah.
Until very recently.
Yeah. So it's like, I think the management at Sega of America played a very big role in just basically shuttering any JRPGs being localized over here.
And fuck Bernie Stolar.
Yeah. So, you know, that kind of set us back. I'm even surprised we got Skies of Arcadia, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, we really lucked out there.
Yeah. So there was that. Apart from that, I remember having a Saturn. It lasted 3 months.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
What happened?
It was working fine one day, and then I powered it on to play some Panzer Dragoon's Y, and it made some nice blue smoke. So that was great. It was pretty spectacular, actually.
I bet.
Yeah.
Probably smelled funky.
Yeah, it smelled funky, and it's like, well, and this was back in the day when you didn't have very many people that did console repairs.
Yeah,
really, which was a real problem. I tried to take it to a guy that did electronics repairs, and it was beyond what he could do. So
yeah, the stink of death usually is.
Yeah, so it was basically, well, I could buy another one, and then I went to Walmart to buy another one, and there were none. So it was like I had bought mine like right that last production run where they just started going away. So I, and you know, there was no online sales back then, so it was like, okay. There's a system I missed out on, so that's why I've been doing a lot of Saturn emulation lately as well to just catch up on the stuff I missed. So
yeah.
And there was some good stuff that I missed. Yes.
Were the later models of the Saturn just less reliable? Because I've got I've had two early models, and those things are they're as functional today as they were the day I bought them.
Yeah. I don't know. I know that the later models were cost reduced quite a bit. So it's possible they ended up using, cheaper components. There was also, back in that time frame of the 90s, there was a rash of bad capacitors that were making it into electronics. It was basically a company that had kind of, through some industrial espionage, stolen the formulations for certain capacitors, but didn't quite get the entire formula, but produced it anyway.
Oh, that's rough.
Yeah, so, you know, there were a whole bunch of companies that were buying up these capacitors that were cheaper, thinking, hey, this is a good deal. Not realizing that they were buying ticking time bombs. So, yeah, that was great. So that's probably one of the things that contributed to the demise of my Saturn. So, yeah.
Yeah.
This is common with Macs of the day, and there's some old some PC graphics cards that came out during that time that had a few of these.
You think those capacitors could have found their way into anything a little more expensive?
Yeah, they did.
Sega Saturns, Macs.
Yeah. So that's what happens when you cost reduce. You look for the best deal, and you never really know what you're going to get. So yeah. And so there was that. So that was my experience with the Saturn. And I'm just glad about emulation, how good it is lately, that I don't feel like I'm really getting a degraded experience in playing an emulated Saturn game. So,
you're not.
Yeah.
So emulation has come so far just in the last couple of years
for
the Saturn.
Yeah.
And obviously we talked on the Day Zero update back then about why that is. But
yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy it's finally here, and that we're really well positioned to preserve the Sega Saturn, because that's a system that's coming face to face with disc rot a lot faster than others seem to be.
Oh yes.
So
yeah, and Kayla has some experience about that. She was talking about
yep,
her Street Fighter collection disc that doesn't quite work the way it's supposed to.
Yep.
But yeah. And the last point I'll make here is the Dreamcast launch. You guys have heard this story already. My launch experience with the Dreamcast consisted of the demo disc and Trick Style for the first week and a half.
Ugh. That sucks. At least the demo disc had Flag to Flag on it.
Yeah, so I played a lot of that. And there was the Monaco Grand Prix, the Ubisoft one. That wasn't too bad either. They had the little demo. I think Sonic Adventure was on that disc.
Yep.
And what was the other one? No, there was a demo of Hydro Thunder and Ready to Rumble. I think those were the other ones. So that was.
I don't think Hydro Thunder was playable, though.
No, I think it was just a video.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was that. And it was, you know, it was an interesting launch time for me because I was seeing all of the reviews of the games that I should have bought. Style. Yeah. Oh, I should also point out there was one other game I was playing I got that same day. It was Blue Stinger. So I made some great decisions on what games to buy. So I probably should have read some magazine reviews before I went to the store, but I was an idiot, and you know.
See, well, here's the thing. I read magazine reviews.
Yeah.
But I lay some of this at the feet of Dreamcast Magazine because they had some games earmarked for the launch that didn't actually make it.
Yes.
And so I planned around those, and that didn't happen. So Marvel vs. Capcom and King of Fighters 98 weren't there.
Yeah.
And so thankfully Soul Calibur and Sonic Adventure were.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was it was definitely disappointment coming home from my trips to the store looking for copies of games that didn't exist yet.
Yes.
Just the what was available once I started playing it absolutely made up for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was kind of my Dreamcast experience early on. I will say that was a system that quickly recovered for me, because after that first month, really did start seeing a lot of really great stuff coming out for the Dreamcast.
Oh yeah.
It was like, maybe if they had delayed the launch 1 month, they could have, made a much stronger impression, but then they wouldn't have had that really cool 9/9/99 launch day. So marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think some of it was third parties falling through too.
Yeah.
Like Sega was not at fault for SNK or for SNK having to delay King of Fighters and Capcom having to delay Marvel versus Capcom.
Yeah.
I think Armada was one of those games that slipped.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sega showed up with all their stuff.
Yeah. So. Mostly, except for Virtua Fighter, that made that.
Yeah.
That didn't make it.
Nope.
And it did make it on the Japanese launch, so go figure.
Right?
Yeah. So, that's as far as, like, the early Sega 60, those are my, my memories. I will say, like, after that, once they started to become a just software-only publisher, I feel like a lot of that magic just kind of went away for me, and I didn't really pay them much attention. Especially when they were like releasing games like Sonic Lost World, and yeah, the less said about that, the better. Yes. So, yeah, but we did get Outrun 2006. So,
yeah, they did recover.
Yeah,
quite nicely, I must say.
Yeah, and right now the Sega that exists today really isn't the same company that it was back then. It's, you know, it's gone through several management changes. It's gone through several philosophy changes. They are a very, well, they're not a huge, huge publisher. But the stuff that they do put out always has an audience. And that's the really interesting thing, is they don't release stuff that doesn't sell. The Total War series has a pretty big following. Football Manager series, you'd think, you know, who's going to like that? But that series is huge. You got like an entire massive cultural community around Warhammer, and you know, Sega owns that. And this is just like the Western stuff that I'm mentioning. I'm not even like touching the surface on like the IPs that they still have, like Sonic, which they're managing to slowly bring back to a state which I would consider relevant again. They do a lot of stuff with their older properties and compilations, like, you know, the Genesis Mini that we talked about for a bit.
That's a masterpiece.
I want to see a Saturn Mini, Sega. Make this happen.
Yes.
So
that would be great.
Yeah.
I could curate a game list tonight.
So that's it for me.
How about you, Teresa?
Well, my first memories of Sega were on the school bus in high school. Because I'm that old. And it was the guys I wish I could have a sleepover with, but that would be totally inappropriate at that point in life. They were bringing their stuff with them. So the one kid, Mark, had a Genesis, and in his duffel bag, he had his Genesis, he had his controllers, he had his games, and he was going over to somebody else's house for a sleepover on a Friday night. This is when they let kids get off wherever. You can't do that. Maybe you can. I don't know if bus drivers care. But he had it, and I was leaning over the seat, looking into the back seat, looking at his Sega thing, and it was all black and beautiful and stuff. And I'm like, and here I am. He was playing this great thing, and the only thing I had access to at that point was my neighbor's NES. That was it. We didn't have Super Nintendo yet. And I was just like, God damn it. So there was some envy there. There definitely was. So then I started dating someone who had a Genesis, like a couple of years after this. Because that's what you do when you don't have your own money, right? No, I'm kidding. It was coincidence. But then, you know, I got to college. Scott had a Genesis. And so we would sit in the dorm rooms and we would play. And it was basically a shit ton of Sonic. Just an absolute shit ton of Sonic. And then my brother had a Genesis. Weekends, I could play his stuff. He had Earthworm Jim, so I'd play that with him. And again, Sonic. But I started getting weird titles here and there, like Clue, which you guys heard me go on and on about how much I played Clue in college. And I did. I really played a lot of it. And Zombies Ate My Neighbors, which is probably my favorite kitschy Sega game.
It's a co-op mainstay.
It was awesome. But also in college, Scott picked up a Game Gear. So
nice.
A lot of columns, and some Mickey's Castle Delusion. And I remember hating that game. I don't know if it was just a bad game or what, but I was like, I should get the thing out of there. And we had a TV adapter for it. So can you imagine, like, how many batteries we chumped through?
Oh, God.
It was like half of a paycheck.
Eventually, it just broke down and got the AC adapter.
Yeah, we probably did at some point. The one thing that we never did score was a Nomad, and he really wanted to get one of those. But we never had that. So later in college, because college lasted a long time for me, his brother ended up getting a Saturn for Christmas. And so I would go over there on the weekends, and I would only have to play future brother-in-law games, which was a lot of Virtua Fighter and a lot of Daytona. One I liked much more than the other. But after he got a little bit older, he was in high school and he didn't really care about his Saturday, he sold it to us. So then I started getting into weirder stuff again. And that's the thing about Sega, man. It's always got these weird titles that you could really get into that you try to explain to people who you're playing. They're like, you can't talk to me anymore. So I was playing like KO Flying Squadron, which we sold for a butt ton, and we did Switch a lot of time afterwards. Nights in a Dream. So we've talked about Christmas Nights and how we would like Christmas, we would break out that little supplemental CD and we pop it in and we play it. And Albert Odyssey and just a bunch of stuff that I ended up playing, and it went through to even we were still playing games after the Dreamcast came out. And really after the Dreamcast hype was died down, we were still playing Saturn games. For the Dreamcast, so you had a sinker there, Phil, with your launch things. I asked my mom for a Dreamcast game for Christmas, and I knew I was going to get a new game. She said I was going to get a new game. I'm a fully grown adult working full-time job who could afford my own new games. Money was tight. It was great to get a new game. It was South Park, Chef's Love Shack.
Oof, thud.
That was kind of ouch. And she got the Dreamcast for me along with it, which was awesome. Mom, she made some good money in '99.
It's the thought that counts, right?
Yeah, right. But soon afterwards, we followed it with some great games. Crazy Taxi. God, I love that game. I was
Yeah.
pissed off at work a couple of weeks ago. I started playing the soundtrack. It helped. It really did. Soul Calibur, which I sucked at, but I like playing. And again, with the weird games, Typing of the Dead, Seaman, Choo Choo Rocket, Space Channel 5. It was, and then there was some semi game.
Yeah, 18-wheeler old, yeah,
Yeah,
American Pro
something Mother
Trucker is what it
Trucker
was
or something.
called.
Okay.
Yeah, it was originally an arcade game, and they converted it to Dreamcast.
That was Model 3, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's just it was weird, kitschy niche stuff, and that was great, and that is what they did so well. They really did, but by far, there is no way that I can not talk about Dreamcast without talking about the weeks on end I spent in Fantasy Online.
Those were the days.
Those were the days that required a broadband adapter, and it was all right. That was okay. But yeah,
Did it
it was
really?
good.
I remember playing it on my dial-up.
I played it on. I played it up. I had SegaNet, so yeah.
Yeah, the problem that I had is I'd already moved on to broadband, and so I literally had to get a
Get it.
broadband adapter.
Yeah, or he couldn't use
But
it.
actually, now that we're saying that, hold on, I'm trying to put myself back where I was. I was living with a friend of mine. I think I had the broadband adapter for it. Because I had to get my separate phone line to get DSL. Yeah, and I got DSL to play with you guys.
I think that we would hook up just to the phone line when we lived in that crappy apartment right next door here. Can you imagine the window rattling? Believe me, you can't. It was ridiculous. But then we moved right after, maybe about right after, but we moved right after. And one of the things that I required in 2000 was that it better fucking not have done. And when we moved, I think that's when I had to buy the broadband adapter for it.
I remember you had to hunt one down for me because you were in Chicago and I was in Logan, Utah, just like we still are. And there was definitely a supply discrepancy between the two regions. So,
Try to find a broadband adapter in like Lachute, Quebec. It wasn't happening, guys.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
My God.
So, it was dial-up for me for like every multiplayer thing. So the great thing about Phantasy Star Online though was that it actually ran really well on dial-up.
Yeah, it was actually coded for dial-up, and as far as the speed of the game goes, there was no difference between no performance difference between broadband and dial-up. The reason that you had the broadband adapter was because that was how you were connecting to the internet.
Basically, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think that remained true for future versions, but I know for the Dreamcast, at the very least, that was how it was.
Yep.
Yeah. And now, as for modern-day stuff, outside of Sonic Mania, I honestly, I can't see any Sega titles other than Phantasy Star Online 2.
We got to get you on that, by the way.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Relive old times.
But I did finally last night bust out the Sega Mini that we have, the Genesis Mini.
Yes.
And we played it. We were playing a lot of stuff. And I was going to let you know that Scott was cheating at Tetris.
Okay, you got to explain this one to me because I didn't even know that was.
How does somebody cheat at two-player Tetris? Well, that little shit started the game while I was in the kitchen trying to get a drink. So that's he basically gave himself a little nice handicap there. So it's like four or five lines deep by the time I finally got there. I'm like, start! But he totally cheated. And I still won.
Just blatantly.
Yeah. I still won. Yeah, we were playing a few things. God, we were swearing so much. We were playing Sonic. It was just ridiculous.
Head-to-head puzzle games are like that.
Yeah. It was fun, and I'm pretty sure that we'll probably be playing it tonight. So
nice.
We'll get our money's worth out of that little system. When I said it, it's... Like I said, it turned randomly like 2 months ago, was it, Pat? I think I texted you right there in the store and I'm like, holy shit, look at this.
Yeah, you did. You took a picture.
Yeah, I was just like, well, I can't let this go. I'm going to have to buy this. It's going to have to come home with me.
Yep.
So, yeah, it was good. Now that it's winter, it's a great time to hibernate and play all the things.
Yep. Yeah, just hack-chi that thing and put some stuff on there.
Yep. I already have a little
list.
I hope, yeah, that too. But I'm pretty sure it's SD card for that one and not.
Just remember, don't stick more than 100 games on your system.
Yeah, unless you use hack-chi, in which case you can go nuts.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Yes, because hack-chi has folders and Lunar does not yet.
I might have to add another item to my to-do list this weekend.
Rehack the. Uninstalling Project Lunar is a little bit of a pain, as you found out.
Yeah. I bricked one trying.
Yeah. So, even after you uninstall it, you actually have to go in with recovery mode. So you can get the shell, and then there's one file you have to go and delete. There's a video. Otherwise, hack-chi doesn't install. It will just go...
Lovely.
Yeah, it won't, brick anything. It'll just go, no, I'm not doing that. So at least there's that.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
So, Lee, how about you?
You know, I feel like I have sort of an interesting history with Sega, because when I was growing up, I was lucky enough to get an NES, and I wanted, later on down the line, I wanted a Sega Master System because it had two-player Double Dragon, and Double Dragon was my favorite game at the arcades at that time. So, what made me go and try to get into anything Sega, was that specifically. My neighbor also had one because he was a spoiled ass kid. And he had the Master System that you could just turn it on and it would start. It had like a Choplifter, I think, installed.
Nice.
And so you could turn it on without a cartridge. And, yep. And so it was like that and Phantasy Star and Double Dragon. And I was just like, I, you know, previous to that, I had basically begged my mom to take me to Toys R Us, I don't know how many times, so we could look for Double Dragon on the Super Nintendo, but I had no idea it was only one player. So that's what kind of had me start looking at Sega. And so I was lucky enough later on, I got a Master System. I loved it. I played, you know, just the basic stuff, the Alex Kidd stuff, Phantasy Star, obviously Choplifter, which I was super, super into, and Double Dragon, but I never really did much with it, you know, past that. And then I was one of those kids that sort of got enveloped in like the, just the 16-bit everything.
Yes.
And so we used to rent, we would convince either me, it was me and my, I had another friend named Lee. So it was me and him, and we would always convince either my mom or his mom to rent us like a Sega Genesis. And it just blew my mind that we could play Altered Beast, and we could play all the stuff that we had played in the arcades, we could play it at home.
And it looks and feels like the arcade.
Exactly. And that was just mind-blowing to us. And so, of course, you know, I begged for a Genesis. I did some work, was able to pick one up. Had it for a few years, loved it. You know, kept it all the way through the end of the 16-bit era. I still have it. It's in my closet somewhere. And you know, just the thing about Sega at the time was I was more of a Nintendo guy, and it was strictly because I liked it felt like at the time, it's not like it is now. But at the time you bought, you know, one of those systems specifically because there was a great amount of certain types of games that were on one system as compared to another. So like with the Genesis, like to Pat, what you were talking about earlier, it was, you know, about arcade, you know, perfect games that had come out. And that was just mind blowing. Whereas it felt like if you had the Super Nintendo, you were in it more for like the RPGs and stuff like that, and more colors and things like that. So I ended up kind of
didn't really have the arcade arm. That,
right.
Yeah, Sega was pumping out the arcade content because they were invested in the arcade market. And exactly. So, yeah, they had the games to put there.
Yeah, and so I ended up sort of moving on from the Genesis and really putting my time into the Super Nintendo, strictly because it felt like the Super Nintendo, in terms of, at least to me, it felt like it had more longevity, because you had, you know, Final Fantasy, you had the best version of Mortal Kombat 2, you had the best version of any of them of Street Fighter. And when Street Fighter 2 came out, that's when I was like, I have to switch, because I grew up in an arcade, you know, like that was my shit. And so that was what made the Genesis so appealing at first. But then when Street Fighter 2 came out, the first one, just plain old vanilla Street Fighter 2, and Genesis didn't have it, I was like, I gotta go. I can't deal with this. So, you know, that was when I switched over to the Super Nintendo. And then I kind of got into like a lot more of the technical aspects of it, with how many colors the Super Nintendo could display compared to like the Genesis. But, and of course the trade-off for that was the Genesis's processor was so much faster than what they had on the Super Nintendo. So it was always just kind of this back and forth, because as much as like 8-bit gaming sort of shaped my ideas about gaming, I really felt like it was the 16-bit era where I started to really figure out what I was into. And that really started from things like Double Dragon, and then moved into Street Fighter II, and then into Final Fantasy and Chrono Trigger and Dragon Quest and all of those things. So it was an interesting time to be a gamer, because if you liked sports games, if you liked arcade games, if you liked fast action games, the Genesis is where you wanted to be. Like I said, if you like, you know, more of the slower stuff, the platformers, the RPG, Street Fighter II, and just typically most of the time, better graphics overall, you went with the Super Nintendo, but they were both very distinct. And I remember Sega was always just kind of, I don't know how to say it, like for lack of a better term, I was just kind of weird. And they would always do, you know, some really interesting things. And, you know, they were always in a lot of ways the underdog, no matter who they were kind of fighting against. You know, in the 8-bit and the 16-bit eras, you know, they were fighting with Nintendo. And then you jumped into the 32-bit era, and then into like, what was it, the 128-bit era, they were fighting against Sony. And so they always sort of had this underdog status, even though I would argue Sega wasn't an underdog company, especially with their arcade games and all that other stuff. Uh-huh. They're racking in a lot of money, but you know, when you're in that home space and you're doing that sort of comparison, you know, you did start to go, damn, these guys really are the underdog. And especially in America, you know, Sega came out throwing haymakers with the whole Genesis does what Nintendo don't ad campaign that really showcased how much power the Genesis had compared to the 8-bit NES that you know, was kind of released against. And so that was a really interesting time. And then I felt like, for me at least, Sega started to stumble as they started moving into the 32-bit era, because you could see from there the creativity that had really driven Sega to do some really unique things then started really driving their hardware. You saw previous to this, you'd seen like you saw the regular Genesis come out. They had that the lock-on cartridge so you could play old Master System games with it. And then they brought out the Sega CD, which again was like Sega trying to take that sort of crazy creativity that they applied to games and also apply it to hardware. And I think this really ended up being a double-edged sword for them, which you guys have somewhat talked about when it came to things like the Dreamcast. But I feel like this is when Sega really poisoned the well. They had brought out the Sega CD, and then after that, they brought out the 32X. And they said specifically, we will not abandon the 32X. There is a place for the 32X and the Saturn for everybody. And so you guys don't have to worry about it. Everything's all good. And we should have all known better. But previous to this, there had been no example where a hardware company was really like, we're going to keep supporting this add-on that you bought and then stop supporting it months later.
Yeah, there's actually a really interesting story about 32X in that Sega of America really never wanted to put that thing out to begin with.
Right.
They were basically saddled with it by Japan. They were saying, well, this we have this add-on, we have this concept that we want to do, make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the mandate from on high over in Japan, and Kalinske and crew were kind of, you know, they were stuck with it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, knowing full well that they have the Saturn coming out a year later, it's like,
It was just, it was a marketing thing. It was, you know, get this money, do this, do that. And, you know, what was interesting about it too, is that I think had the 32X had some time to breathe, it would have given Sega some maneuvering room. But because this is also the same Sega that had done something super cool, like Sonic and Knuckles, where you could, you know, put Sonic and Knuckles in and then attach, you know, Sonic 2 to it. And you essentially had like a completely different game based on the same framework that was there. And like that was kind of the stuff that Sega had done and was super cool. And you look at like what they did in arcades with moving cabinets, stuff like Afterburner 2, that were all about, here's this hardware thing that we can do with our software to create a unique experience. And you sort of see that in the DNA of the 32X, but just, you know, it the market was not in a place to absorb that, and Sega wasn't in a place where they wanted to support that. And then I think the, you know, for me, that was when Sega started kind of, you know, sloping downward, because you had the Saturn, which was something I was super excited about because of the same reason that I was excited about the Genesis, which was arcade games. We had seen what the Saturn could do as far as 2D gaming, but you know, it was really underpowered for 3D. And of course, they, you know, they redid the architecture and they had those two 32-bit RISC chips in there that just made developing for the thing a huge pain in the ass. And really only Sega could really, really get strong 3D out of the Saturn. And so you take that, and the thing to understand at the time is that nobody knew what to expect from Sony entering the market. And Sega seemed to know, at least in my opinion, that Sony was coming in to eat their lunch in the same way that they had kind of eaten Nintendo's lunch for a long time. And they made the worst mistake, Sega, was they released the Saturn early. It was like, they if I recall correctly, it's been a long time, but they just basically said, here's a press conference, and oh, by the way, it's out. And
that was at E3.
Yeah, that was at E3. Yeah, exactly.
The very first E3 in Atlanta.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had priced it at $3.99 and said, here it is, it's out in the wild. But they also surprise. Had right, and they didn't give it to everyone. Like, there was, I remember at the time, a bunch of retailers being up in arms because they didn't get the Saturns. I think, like, Toys R Us got them, KB, and I want to say, like, Service Merchandise and maybe a couple of other places. But not, they weren't available where you would normally buy video games. And some people got caught out. And I'm definitely going to have to go back and look this up. Maybe we can add it to the show notes as a correction. But I remember that just vividly. I remember how much that pissed off retailers. And then Sony shows up, they have the PlayStation, and they're like, yo, $299. And if that sounds familiar, it kind of mirrors what happened with the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One, where Sony just kind of strolled in and was like, yeah, we see your price, we're doing ours $100 lower. And on top of that, the 3D, because the PlayStation was easier to design for, just ended up being a lot better. And you couple that with Sony kind of, in my opinion, taking the place that Sega had, as I'd said a moment ago, had kind of set themselves up in with Nintendo, they came in as the underdog. And that led to the PlayStation being enormously successful. And, you know, from that, you see, you know, a couple of years down the line, Sega just completely abandons the Saturn in the United States. And so what that does is that creates, at least in America, a type of situation where Sega customers basically got burned. If they bought the 32X and the Sega CD, really not a lot of support. Sega CD had a lot more than the 32X did. But if you bought the 32X or really anything that Sega had done an add-on for, you kind of got fucked. And then if you had the Saturn and then they pull out completely of you know, development, selling it, everything else out here, but it's still you know, lively in Japan. Again, as a consumer, you're like, damn, I dropped $400 on this thing and however much I spent on games on it, and they're just going to fucking abandon me? Like, eat a dick. Mm-hmm. And so then Sega really tried to you know, climb back up that hill, which I would argue they did successfully and not successfully with the Dreamcast. The Dreamcast is one of my favorite launches of all time, but I was apathetic to Sega because of the Dreamcast. Because what was funny is I remember I went and I put down my pre-order for it, and I think I had to pay like $50, I think it was, and I did it at a store that is, you know, now long since gone, called Media Play. And I had the money for it. It launched at $199, and I just remember going, this looks great. This seems to be the same thing that got me in with the Genesis. It's like these arcade games and this new stuff, and it is Sega, you know. So, you know, maybe I should jump into this. Maybe this is something I want to do. But I actually let my pre-order sit there for a couple of days until Media Play called me and said, are you going to come get this thing? Because if you're not, we'll refund you your money and we'll sell it to somebody else. And I was like, okay, you know what? Yeah, I will. And I went and got it. I picked it up. I got Soul Calibur. I got Sonic and Crazy Taxi. And you know, you get that stuff, you plug it in, you're like, holy fucking shit, Sega's back. And I have more fond memories with that system than almost any other system that I have. And it came down specifically to two things. It came down to Phantasy Star Online with you guys, and CVS2. And then of course later Third Strike, even though it was not quite perfect. And all of that was just because it gave me a connection to people in a way that I really hadn't experienced since I had been in arcades. And so with PSOs, I was able to log in with you guys and we could just murder shit and have a good time. And I remember buying the keyboard for it so I could talk to everybody. I got broadband so I could, you know, go as fast as possible. And then with like Street Fighter, it was like, you know, getting arcade sticks made, like not like the shitty, I didn't like the one that Sega had out. I think I wasn't very good with Japanese style sticks at the time. I argue I'm still really not. But like that turned into buying a MOS stick for my Dreamcast. And then that turned into, you know, getting super, super, super into the fighting game scene and, you know, finding people out here that I consider family just from playing, you know, fighting games. And so, and all of that ties into the Dreamcast. And so because of that, I have just a tremendous amount of fond memories tied to Sega. But, you know, as looking at it, like analytically, it's not hard to see why they also fucked up, because they did something very similar with the Dreamcast in that the first year, they did something very similar with the Dreamcast that they did with the Saturn, in that the first year was really stellar, and after that it fell off. And a lot of that also had to do with the market at the time, where a lot of people were like, I'm not going to buy a Sega console because Sega has fucked me before, and the PlayStation 2 is around the corner. And that was the only time that I've ever seen, as long as I have been involved in video games, writing about them, talking about them, you know, any of that stuff, the only time I have ever seen a company get murdered before their rival even put out a product came with the Dreamcast, because I knew so many people that would have loved what was on the Dreamcast, but they simply were unwilling to give Sega the benefit of the doubt. And that sort of became this self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Like, Sega comes out, puts out a bunch of really killer stuff, and stuff that really felt like moving into the next generation. But you just had a lot of people sit out on the sidelines going, you know what, I'll wait, because, you know, Sega's done me dirty, and I'm going to see what Sony does. And then Sony came in like an 800-pound gorilla and just beat the ever-living shit out of Sega. And then, you know, on top of that, there ended up being a pretty huge flaw in the Dreamcast where piracy for it was really easy.
It was so easy. It unlocked itself.
Yeah. So you take that, you have Sony there staring them down. You have their bad, you know, business decisions beforehand that have kind of, I think, soured consumers to them. And it just led to the storm that really led to sinking Sega's ship, as it were. And I don't think that they've ever been as good as a software company as they were as a hardware company. And I think that, especially now, I feel like that's really sad, because at the time after the Dreamcast, you know, had failed, or previous to it failing, I'd worked with this guy on a fanzine, and I wrote this byline for this thing that says, like, the Dreamcast is dead and Sega just doesn't know it. And I remember catching so much shit about it. And yeah, I was right.
Totally right, though.
Yeah, and they pulled out like a year later. And part of my argument came from the fact, like, Sega came out swinging, but then that second year they had nothing. Like, if you are going to, and nothing is arguable, by the way, but in terms of like trying to get those old folks back into the fold, the people that were previous Sega fans or that might be willing to jump in and see what you're doing, they didn't offer a lot to them that I think was really, really appealing. They could have gone back and made a new Shinobi. They could have gone back and made another Golden Axe. They could have done a lot of things that would have pulled in those, you know, kind of retired Sega heads or whatever you want to call them, and go, here's some stuff that we have. And then there's also this cool new stuff that we have. And then there's like this really weird shit that we have. And you know, you see stuff like what happened with Shenmue, you know, where it's like, this is a really interesting and at the time ambitious game. But just like everything else with Sega, it was unfinished, and I that's sort of like the conundrum. And
the price tag.
Oh, the price tag didn't help. Yeah,
$60 million.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like bad decisions being made to do something that they at least felt was groundbreaking, and you can only make so many of those things where it doesn't pay out for you, to where, you know, it really kills you. And so that's one of those things that's always made me sad, because that innovation on the other hand, for somebody like Nintendo, has most of the time seemingly worked out, but it's never been as radical as the stuff that Sega was doing when you compare it to Nintendo. Like, Nintendo is like, you know, here's a fucking steering wheel, stick your Wii remote in it. You know, yeah. Sega was like, here's a cartridge game, stick this other thing into it and watch what happens, you know? Or here's a thing that you can stick inside your Genesis that's going to make it more powerful. Here's a CD-ROM drive that you can attach to it. You know, here's a fucking fishing controller for your Dreamcast to play Seaman, you know, the less we say about that game, the better. But, you know, there was a lot of interesting things that could have been done, but I just feel like a lot of them weren't done in a financially sound way. And that really sunk them. And that makes me sad. It makes me sad to this day, because, I think we need that sort of weird, like, quirkiness, that I don't know if I would call it an edge, but there was something in the DNA at Sega of that time, up until the Dreamcast kind of ceased, that was unique to the game industry. And we have not seen it represented, in my opinion, really since. I feel like the only time we really got a taste of that was with the original Xbox. The original Xbox, to me, felt like an extension of the Dreamcast.
But
it never really lived up to it either. So,
yeah, what's kind of, I want to just kind of piggyback onto that a little bit, because what bothers me about the Dreamcast, and I guess I will say bothers me because it was the console that almost made it. There was, if you remember, like during that time in Sega, Bernie Stolar, fuck you, was at the helm. Well, he was eventually like kicked to the curb, and Peter Moore was at the head of Sega of America. Now, what he was doing, he started bringing stuff like we got Skies of Arcadia because he realized, hey, people like JRPGs. We should probably bring some of those. So, you know, we got Seaman as weird and quirky. You know, we got Space Channel 5 as all of those things were part of that Sega DNA that he was trying to bring back. The problem was, and the biggest issue that he had was, by that time, the PS2 was right around the corner, and he could not get third parties to sign on to the Dreamcast anymore. So it was Nintendo might be able to pull off a single publisher console, but Sega couldn't do it. And that's, you know, that's really where it ended up going. All the third parties went to the PS2, and it kind of left the Dreamcast library very stagnant until they eventually just had to pull the plug on it, and that was it. Yeah. And then Peter Moore went to Microsoft, and
exactly. There you go. And that's why it felt like the Xbox was sort of like the Dreamcast 2. And I would argue the final form of what Sega wanted was what happened with the Xbox 360. Because the Xbox 360, while I wouldn't say it had as many like crazy or random ass games that the Dreamcast had, it was sort of the final form of what Sega was trying to achieve, which was a powerful console that was broadband connected, had an online presence. You could download stuff too. And I feel like Microsoft really kind of evolved that idea with things like Summer of Arcade. Like the indie game boom that we have really started with Braid, you know, and you found that on the Xbox 360. And so I've always felt like Microsoft, at least as people, when Peter Moore was there, kind of had that Dreamcast DNA tied into the Xbox. And I do feel a little bit of it there with like Phil, with just like, you know, he made sure we got Phantasy Star Online on the Xbox. And you know, he's reached out to, I think, you know, to really try and at least get some Japanese style games on there. And then also just have, at least at the time, I felt like, you know, with the 360, and I'm hopefully we'll see it now with the Series X. I think you saw two things. I think in the 360, you really saw a diversity of games, and with what Microsoft is doing with the what they did with the One, and then what they've done with the Series X and S is really leaned into their catalog in a way that I felt like Sega used to do. So I've always felt like there's a bit of Sega DNA, at least in the way that they operate, is with Microsoft. But Microsoft's got a lot more money to take chances. Like the Kinect is a very Sega-esque idea. You know, it's not something that you would see Nintendo do, and it's sure as shit not something that you'd see Sony do if somebody hadn't done it first. But this idea that you could just play a completely different way, that always felt very Sega to me. And like I said, there's a part of me that really would love to have Sega still around as a hardware maker, but I just think that they probably wouldn't make good decisions. But the Dreamcast, I think, is the pinnacle of their game development. And brought so much to, you know, to my life when I was, you know, right at the edge of being a teenager and being in my 20s and solidified, you know, the relationships that I have with a lot of people that still stand today, including like with you guys. Like I remember skipping work to play PSO with you guys. Like I remember one time we played for like 14 hours straight. I've never done that in my life.
That was a great day.
Yeah. I've never done that in my life before or since, you know, and that just would not have happened without the Dreamcast, because it was all of us kind of in the right place at the right time with the right frame of mind and the right tech, you know, because it's like, fuck. I mean, even now I'd imagine trying to get us all together to do anything besides this podcast would be really fucking difficult. But at the time with the Dreamcast, it was like, yo, you know, you get on the internet, guys, I'm logging in. All right, cool. See you there. And the next thing you know, we're fucking full up and we're running around, you know, it's never going to be like that again. And I would argue we would have never probably done something like that in that way had it not been for Sega. So I just have a tremendous fondness for Sega, just because of that, because of the fighting game community, it really helped me become a part of. And you know, here I am with you guys, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Alex Watchtower can eat a dick, though. That's a deep, deep cut.
It is.
Sega,
wow.
Sega fucking fanboy.
But, yeah, we got to get you on PSO2.
Yes.
Yeah, I need to install it. Yeah, I'm gonna find some time. I have to play the WoW expansion and level up with my wife because she's doing that. And I'll find some time. I'm off at the end of December for a bit, so I think I'll probably install it then and figure out, you know, what to do. And at least I can play it in different places. I can play it on the Xbox or I can play it on my PC. So, and
if I can drag the family, I can use.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. But yeah, like I said, that's, to me, the legacy that Sega has, you know, is you guys and is the fighting game community and is people that I consider family. Like the all of that was kind of brought together to me and for me because of Sega. You know, with Sega, it started with, you know, arcade games, and then, you know, obviously that shifted to Capcom with Street Fighter 2, which then tied in later to the Dreamcast and finding, you know, shoryuken.com, and then finding out, holy shit, there's fucking thousands of people that are out there like me that are into this shit. And, yep. And also took the form, like I said, of PSO with us just, you know, here we are, Phil in fucking Canada. I'm in Atlanta. Pat's out in Utah. Teresa, I think you were living in the same place, weren't you? You were still in Chicago,
right?
I was
3 fucking miles away.
Yeah. So here we are, like,
I was only 8 blocks from where I am now.
Yeah. So here we are. Yeah. I was probably about 3 miles from where I live now, to be honest. Like, I haven't really moved around. But yeah, think about that. Like, these disparate people able to find each other through, you know, loving games. And then, you know, again, it's so easy to understate now because there's so many online versions of everything. But PSO at the time, if you didn't have a PC, like, I wasn't new to playing games online. I'd been playing StarCraft and all kinds of shit. But playing a console game with your friends online, yeah, it's mind-blowing.
It put couch co-op online.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's Sega's legacy for me. And so I wish they could definitely do hardware, you know, in the future. That probably will. That's never going to happen. Besides, like, minis. Like, yeah, besides like the minis. But like even now, like I find myself, like, you know, we a lot of Dreamcast stuff has been remastered or remixed or just re-released. But like, we still don't have Skies of Arcadia, which is so disappointing. But yeah, I will always love Sega for the people that kind of got brought into my life because of the connections that they allowed me to make. So yeah.
Absolutely. So Kayla, how about you?
Well, my first console was actually the Sega Master System, which I got for my first day from a friend of my dad's. So I learned how to play games on the Sega Master System, and then I eventually got a Genesis, and even though I had Nintendo consoles, to me, Sega was synonymous with gaming, which was probably unusual unless you were in Europe or Brazil, where Sega was a little bit more popular. So
it's that arcade pedigree, too.
I really loved Sega up until the point of the 32X. And if you don't notice, the 32X actually came out this very same day that Donkey Kong Country came out, which I don't think was a good look, and I don't think it did much favors for Sega, because basically it said Nintendo could do all these amazing things with the Super NES, and Sega, you need to buy a whole separate accessory to be able to get better graphics.
Yeah.
So I lost a lot of interest in Sega, actually, until the Dreamcast, which I think was basically like just the high point of gaming for me, and really is something that will never, ever, ever be replicated, because
was really a special time.
The game, just the library that they were launched it with was amazing. And you know, Lee, you're right. Absolutely right. Gaming has lost a lot. It's gaming's very different since Sega. dropped out, and since the days of the original Xbox, like, publishers are not willing to take the same risk that Sega was willing to take. You know, like, you look at a game like Seaman. That was a weird fucking game.
That might be the weirdest game.
Or you look at games like Choo Choo Rocket, which was even that was a kind of a weird game, especially since it was mostly just meant to be played online. Sega really took a lot of risks, and some of them paid off, and some of them were really stupid. But to me, Sega's so synonymous with gaming to me because I still play all the Sonic games that come out, no matter how bad they suck. But something I also really wanted to touch on was the Sega Activator, which is really still the worst game controller ever made. And it was really the predecessor to the Kinect. And I still have it. It's still in its box, laying underneath my Sega Saturn and Dreamcast. And I've actually tried to set it up a few times during this quarantine, and I don't think it works anymore. I don't think it ever worked, actually. But again, you know, just going to the idea of Sega making really risky moves. And if you look at games right now and accessories and consoles, nobody wants to take risks. Everything is very much decided by marketing and decided by what's the most popular genre of games at the time. And just, you know, the days of Sega making all these strange games and strange accessories, no matter even if they didn't work, that's probably not going to happen ever again. So to me, yeah. Sega is synonymous with risk-taking and just gaming in general.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of that, that Sega as the centerpiece of your gaming, goes back to that arcade identity that they really dominated around that time. Because I mean, people like us, we're arcade gamers at heart. And we've already talked about this at length, but that was where Sega earned their paycheck. And so it makes sense that coming from that influence that you would gravitate more towards Sega platforms as your mains.
Yeah. Question I have, Kayla, for you is, it sounds like you kind of skipped over the Saturn. So what made you go back to it?
Well, I didn't get a Saturn until Patrick actually recommended it back in 2003 because I wanted a console that could play 2D fighting games as close to arcade quality as possible because I was really getting into fighting games at the time. Yep. So that's what really got me into the Sega Saturn.
Yeah, those were some good conversations, just being able to revisit at length what kind of led to the Saturn and the types of games that it specialized in.
Yeah.
Those were good times.
Yeah. I also love how easy to import Saturn games were. All you needed was the RAM expansion and you were good to go.
Yeah. The 5-in-1. And the only problem with that was, usually you ended up buying from Buyright and,
sketchy as all hell.
Yeah. And today it would be criminal.
Yeah. It kind of would be.
Yeah. I mean, in all honesty, but
we will send you a game, the games that you told us to send you, but we won't tell you how much it's actually going to cost until it gets to you.
Or will we give you a tracking number?
Yeah.
So Sega's 60th anniversary isn't the only anniversary that we're celebrating here. Sonic the Hedgehog also has a 30th anniversary this year. And so let's talk about Sonic for a bit. My initial experience with Sonic the Hedgehog kind of came to an end a little earlier than it did for some people because Sonic 3 was the first time that I had trouble getting into a Sonic game. I loved 1 and 2, but the third game just, I don't know, it felt like there was, with some of the level design, I think it was, that they took the steps that didn't need to be taken. And to this day, I haven't really memorized any of the Sonic 3 stages the way I have the 1 and 2s. Just because there's so damn much of them.
Yeah, they were.
And it was great for exploration, but it didn't stick with me the same way that the level design from the first two games did. And so that kind of, I think I've beaten Sonic 3 once in my life, but I did come back around. I played Sonic Adventure, had a blast with that. And of course, Sonic Mania really, like, that is what I want in a Sonic game. If they can just keep, if they could shoot that into my veins, I would have that done. But the first two games I think of as among the absolute pinnacle of platformers. Like, I would put those two games in the same box as the first three Mega Man X games. But yeah, Sonic 3 just didn't quite do it for me, and then they kind of went off on their whole 3D Blast and, you know, the false start with Extreme. But I like the adventures more than most people seem to, and I think the series is poised to do some really great things now.
I hope so.
Keep their Anything Goes policy for fan works, and then keep the team that they have for Sonic Mania on board. Yeah, there's a lot of potential there. So, Kayla, how about you?
So, Sonic's my favorite game franchise. And again, I pretty much play all the Sonic games that come out. And I've been going through the Sonic Mega Collection on the Xbox lately because I've been trying to record all of the Sonic games for my YouTube channel. And the Sonic Mega Collection is really interesting because it's the only compilation that has the Game Gear games, which were mostly pretty awesome. The Sonic Mega Collection, of course, came out for Xbox, PS2, and GameCube. And ever since then with recent compilations, they've all kind of sucked. Some of them don't have Sonic 3 or Sonic Knuckles. Some of them, the latest one that came out, which was a compilation of Genesis games, the input delay is so terrible that you can't even play it. So I guess really what my big wish for this 30th anniversary is that we get a great Sonic compilation again.
Yeah.
And that they put all of the Sonic Game Gear games on it, all of the Sonic Advance games on it. Sonic Pocket Adventure for the Neo Geo Pocket would be great. Sonic Eraser, which only came out on the Japanese MegaNet, would be great too. And really, I would like to just see Sega just get these games back out there so people can play them, because Sonic was amazing on handheld consoles.
Yeah. One of the things that I made a point to have on my PlayStation Classic is the Sonic Adventure or Sonic Advance series, especially, and also have Pocket Adventure on there for that very reason, because it just works. Sonic handheld games tend to be among the best games in the series.
And now you can play them without going through a bunch of batteries.
Yeah. Or needing a backlight in the case of the Neo Geo Pocket.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Let's see. Phil, how about you?
So for me, the Sonic games were a high point in the 16-bit era, and that's pretty much where it ended for me up until very recently. Unlike you, I actually loved Sonic 3. I thought it was just a technical and design marvel, especially considering that game was half of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was ambitious.
Yeah, well, that whole Sonic and Knuckles thing came about because they needed to make the deadline for Sonic 3, and Yuji Naka, as we know, is a crazy person. Yes. And he wanted to do a lot more with Sonic, and they came up with the idea, well, why don't we release the first half of this game, and then you keep on working on the rest of the levels, and then a few months later, you can put out the other one as a separate cartridge, and then Block-On happened. That was a really great and innovative idea. It also meant that Sega could charge you twice for the same game, which was great. Well, great for them. But
it set a precedent.
So, yes. Although, you know, if you played Sonic and Knuckles on its own, it was a different set of levels. But
yeah,
if you locked it on with Sonic 3, you essentially got the complete game. So there was that. But, you know, past that, you know, being that I can't really play handheld games, so I kind of missed all of those up until I started doing emulation and I could play those. I thought Sonic Advance, at least the first one, was a little rough. But they kind of smoothed it out with the second one. So, yeah, it was definitely good games to be had there. But again, 2D. Once Sonic started making the move to 3D, I feel like I didn't really care for them too much. Adventure, you know, was fine for what it was.
It's an acquired taste.
Yeah, well, I mean, I played it, I finished it. I had it on my Dreamcast after I got through that disaster of a launch. So, you know, I enjoyed it. But I wasn't really compelled to go out and run to the store and buy Sonic Adventure 2 when that came out. I was like, okay, yeah, so they fixed a bunch of this, but yeah, I'm not really feeling the game as a whole, so why am I going to bother? And, you know, then they went to the PS2, and things just kind of went downhill from there. There were some pretty decent ones on the Wii. What was it? Is it Sonic Colors, I think, was actually kind of good.
That one was outstanding.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had whatever the hell Sonic Lost World was. But,
we don't talk about Sonic Lost World.
Yeah, so we got that recently. We got kind of dueling Sonics, dueling approach with Forces and Mania. We know how that battle went.
Yep.
So apparently the Sonic fan base is more into the 2D stuff than the 3D. So I'm
apparently they make it really well too.
Yeah. Well, that's that whole. Being okay with fan games actually ended up paying dividends because it ended up netting them a very talented development studio.
Yes.
Well, which consisted of three people at the time, but it ballooned pretty quickly afterwards.
Yeah.
So it was that. That's kind of been my experience with the Sonic games. It's like, I like them, but I'm not like the hugest fan of the game or the character. You know, he's all right, but yeah, I could take him or leave him. Really,
that's fair.
Yeah, Teresa,
I don't know. I'm sure it's out there, but no, I don't. I don't want to play Sonic on my phone. That's a stupid idea. Never mind. I withdraw that thought. yeah, I don't think that's going to work. You know, if I had to have like some really crazy grand wish list, I would want a VR Sonic Spinball. Who doesn't want to puke?
Okay.
They do crazy stuff.
But I mean that's the kind of game that would actually work in VR. But you know, something there have been like people who have recreated Green Hill Zone in VR in Unity, and it's like, yeah, no, just because you can do something in VR does not mean you should.
It's called weaponizing it. That you can use VR for good or you can use VR for evil, and they've clearly made their decision.
Yeah.
So. And this wouldn't. I mean, this honestly would probably just be PC. I don't see that happening anywhere else.
Mm.
But if we could have some crazy wish list for the future, I would do that because we already have all the old games. You know, they're all out there. So what more can we ask for? Now we have to start grabbing for things. And I wonder if this is how they felt too. You know, when they were trying to figure out what do we do next? what haven't we already done? You know, it could be really hard to come up with new ideas for stuff, and I don't want to rehash the old stuff right now.
How about you, Lee?
I think Sonic was interesting, but I always felt like the flow of Sonic never worked for me that well. Like, I get really fucking fast running around, enjoying myself, running into a fucking wall. At least in Sonic 1. I felt like Sonic 2 was as good as the series ever got, and then I thought what they did with Sonic and Knuckles was awesome. And I really enjoyed the what was it, Sonic Adventure or whatever, on Dreamcast. In fact, one of the first games that I bought, and it was just like, wow, this is neat, and then I never finished. So, you know, I also, though, I loved Sonic Mania, you know, and so I think Sonic is just a weird character to try and translate. I do know that it was also one of the... I look at Sonic probably differently than other people in that I feel like Sonic was also one of the things that kept Sony in the ring with Nintendo. Because if you guys remember, before Sonic was out, everybody was like, why doesn't Sega have a mascot? Like, they were like, well, they got, like, Alex Kidd. People were like, fuck Alex Kidd.
Yeah.
You know, well, they got Shinobi. Yeah, but they haven't really put out any of those fucking games. Like, who is their Mario? And Sonic was the answer. And Sonic, in a lot of ways, at least like when you look at it, is sort of like, I always felt like kind of like, you know, Sega's attitude personified. But, yeah. You know, also with Sonic 2, you had the bullshit of like blast processing, which really was just faster processor, you know, but like everything had to be a buzzword, you know? So,
yeah.
So I look at Sonic more as, this idea that solidified Sega's personality more than anything else, because it wasn't just a disparate, you know, amount of arcade games that were on the system or these random things. It was, this is Sonic. This is who Sega is, in the same way that Mario is the mascot for Nintendo. I really looked at it that way.
And you, like, the moment you see that commercial or gameplay footage, however you were introduced to Sonic the Hedgehog, you knew right away, this is it. This is Sega getting to that level.
Yeah, they found it. And to their credit, you know, Sonic worked with the system's best attributes. The reason it was so fast was because that processor was so much better. They kind of worked around the fact that the Genesis could only display 64 colors at a time by taking the 64 colors that they could used for Sonic and really creating like a patchwork pattern across like the hills and things like that. There were just two tones. And you saw that in like Sonic 2 with the corkscrews and stuff like that. So they were able to take, you know, really what felt like a limitation, amp up the speed and still make it really, really colorful. And you couple that with the fact that, like, especially like with Sonic 1 and Sonic 2, the soundtracks were just fucking banging, you know? Yeah. I mean, still to this day, even like you could probably wake me up from a coma with like Green Hill Zone. Yeah. Like, you just know
Masato
that song.
Nakamura.
Yeah. You know that. And I wouldn't say it's, you know, as well known as obviously like, you know, World 1-1 in Mario. Yeah. I think that's probably the most well-known theme of any video game ever, but yeah. I definitely would say it's top five.
Mm-hmm. It's up there. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was, again, it was all of that stuff coalescing and sort of really forming an identity for Sega. So that's more what I think about when I think about Sonic, is like Sega's attitude. And it's ironic that, you know, again, after, you know, it felt like Sonic 2 and then, you know, they did Sonic 3, then Sonic and Knuckles, that it kind of went weird.
Yeah.
It did.
It definitely went off the rails for a while.
Yeah.
Well, are you going to not talk about the movie?
The movie was dope. The movie was dope. I got to give him credit on that. My son is a big Sonic fan. He's a much bigger Sonic fan than I am. And so when Sonic the Hedgehog was coming out and then they did that first run of what Sonic would look like, I was like, wow, it's exactly what I expect from Sega. And then they redid it. And then it kind of came about like, wow, this is exactly what I expect from Sega. So like that weird sort of like, you know, that duality of it, like, they're going to fuck this up. changed into, damn, they stuck the landing. Yeah. You know? So obviously it wasn't Sega making the fucking movie, but you know what I mean? It's the same idea. And the movie was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I freaking Jim Carrey was great as being a psychopath, which, I mean, it's not a stretch, but
yeah, his Robotnik was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Sure, that was the last movie we saw in the theater before shut it all down. And you know, I'm not upset that was the last one, and I don't think that it's going to be the last forever. I'm pretty sure that they might just
shit up again. Yeah, you know they're going to do a second one. Because I don't think anybody expected the first one to do as well as it did.
No, and that's all anybody could talk about for about 2 weeks was, holy shit, have you seen the Sonic movie?
And yeah, it was legitimately good.
Yeah, it was just a great time. So, I think that's definitely something that they did right when they. We got to at least give them some credit there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy that especially in 2020, you'd be like, yeah, a Sonic movie. I'll watch that shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think the fact that Pikachu kind of went the long way to, you know, making something like Sonic work, because they kind of took that whole concept and just... You know, they made it fun. They made it look good. They made it something that you could adults would get quite a bit of enjoyment out of, and kids would really enjoy because they enjoyed the franchise as well. So it's like, you know, that I think that movie kind of laid the groundwork for Sonic to succeed. And not that it should be taking credit for it, but I think in the minds of a lot of people, and that after seeing Detective Pikachu, then looking at the Sonic movie, they would be going, yeah, okay, I could see how this would work.
Yeah, there's definitely a one thing leads to another dynamic there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially with what used to be a kind of a Sonic
movie. Well, Sonic was a better movie, though, too. Like, I feel like it was worth pointing out. We saw Detective Pikachu, and it was like, it's all right. It's all right. Sonic was like, damn, all right, that's pretty good.
And I think
it comes down to, at least for me, everybody that was in the Detective Pikachu movie felt like a bit character. And I didn't feel that way with Sonic. And then I think they elevated Sonic with Jim Carrey as Dr. Robotnik. That dude hysterical.
Yeah, he was great. Mm-hmm. He was great. But and then it wasn't like a crazy scary movie or anything either. And not that I'm saying Detective Pikachu was, but I walked out there saying, I do not want to live in a Pokemon world. That it was, no, let's not do that.
Yeah, and Detective Pikachu got weird. Like, I'm Mew. I'm going to help you fucking fix the world and shit. Sonic was like, I just don't want to get shot.
Yeah, basically.
You know?
Yeah,
so I think that was the other thing.
Yeah, yeah, it was far more reachable and understandable for other people, for non-gaming fans. So more universal.
Yeah, I think the other thing, and because I know the last thing I'll say about that, to me, what's interesting about Sonic as well is that I feel like it is also indicative of Sega's ability and inability to be flexible and change, right? Like Sonic came along, it really solidified, in my opinion, the attitude that Sega had and kind of who they were in the console space. But after a while, they just didn't know what to do with Sonic. And that's why we've had more bad Sonic games than we've had good ones. And I think it just kind of also is you can look to Sonic to see some of the dysfunction that, you know, kind of overtook Sega for a long time. And maybe not even, maybe dysfunction is too strong of a word. Maybe it's just lack of focus, you know?
Oh, Sega 1994, 1995 was complete dysfunction. So that's not a strong enough word.
All right, well, cool. We'll go with it then.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very much like a bellwether for the way that that company behaved. You could see in the games that they produced, specifically Sonic, you know.
And with that, I think we've got a show. You can subscribe to us on Anchor FM, Pocket Cast, Spotify, and many other places. The list is growing steadily. You can also support us on Patreon, get yourself some access to early release episodes, and even submit ideas for topics that you would like to see us cover on the show. And finally, if you've got any questions, comments, feedback, you can email us at thegamerswithoutborders@gmail.com. Once again, that is thegamerswithoutborders@gmail.com. So with Teresa Sammons, Kayla Owen, Lee Lamb, and Filippo Dinolfo, I've been Patrick Mifflin. We will see you next time.